Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show features my conversation with writer and producer Chrissy Levinson. In celebration of Father's Day, we discuss Chrissy's relationship with her father, acclaimed television writer Richard Levinson. This episode is incredibly moving, and I hope it will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Many of you probably remember the character Ava from the feature film Freedom Writers. But what you may not know is that the character Ava is based on one of my original Freedom Writers named Maria. Maria revered her father, who tragically had been arrested by white police officers. And when she entered my classroom, she told me that she hated white people because of what they had done to her father. She wasn't interested in learning English, let alone moving past her prejudice. That was until she was introduced to the story of Anne Frank. Like Maria, Anne Frank adored her father. And as Maria read the diary of Anne Frank, she began to connect with this little girl trapped in an attic, longing to be free. What I didn't know at the time was that Maria was unaware of how Anne's story ended. When Maria burst into my classroom one day, disheartened by Anne's death, my heart sank. That was until my student Darius stood up and reminded her that Anne wasn't gone. Anne wrote her story. We still have it. She is still with us. From that moment on, the Freedom Writers and I understood the power of a written legacy. By writing your story, you can live on forever. Today's guest, Chrissy Levinson, can certainly attest to that. Chrissy's father, Richard, created many popular TV shows, such as Columbo and Murder, She Wrote. He wanted to share with Chrissy small snapshots of her life, their father-daughter relationship, and the changing world around them. He did this the only way he knew how, by writing. Every year on Chrissy's birthday, starting on the night that she was born, Richard would sit down at his typewriter and write her a letter. Just like Anne Frank, Richard now lives on through his literary legacy. Without further ado, for our Father's Day tribute, here is my conversation with Chrissy Levinson. Chrissy, you are going to be our Father's Day special. And so I'm so excited to discuss a subject that every time I think of you, I think of your father. And sadly, I never got to meet your father. So I think what you do so vividly as a storyteller and a writer is you paint pictures. And so for our listeners around the globe, you're going to paint a picture of your father. And as you paint a picture of your father, my hope is that our listeners can also visualize their own fathers. So for our listeners who are not familiar with your story, I want to go back to your birth. And this this miraculous moment happened after you were born. You came early, I believe. And your father, who is a prolific writer, did what he always does. He went to his little Smith Corona typewriter and started typing. And what did your father do on the eve of your birth?
Something extraordinary, because you'd think what he'd first want to do is take a nap. But although that's probably more what my mom wanted to do after having me. My dad, who was an amazing writer himself, did, I think, what came very naturally to him. He left my mom at the hospital because that's what dads did then, and came home and wrote me a letter. And it was the first of many, not enough, but a chunk of letters that he would write to me every year on my birthday. So he started that night, as I think I constantly say, punch drunk, because he was a little bit slap happy and there were definitely typos. He was giddy, I think, in a way that for a very kind of, my dad had a great sense of humor and he was super smart and super cool, but I think he was overwhelmed with this huge change that had just happened with this little person who was me.
And I love that your dad, on an old school typewriter, sat down, and even though he was a professional writer, you said there was typos and misspelling. I love that as a writer.
Let's be clear about a couple things. Number one, my dad, who created numerous television shows and started writing when he was a teenager in Philadelphia in his basement with the man who would become his writing partner for almost 50 years. He typed on old school typewriters with two fingers, which I do as well, which just cracks me up, and was a terrible speller, as am I, but I have spell check.
And a typewriter does not.
No, I know, right? So he actually, and what he would do, which amazed me, slight tangent, but I love this fact, he would go in and he would type one page, and then he would rewrite it, and then he would rewrite it again. before moving on, for example, like in a script, he would rewrite the same page over and over of dialogue over and over until it was ready because you couldn't read his writing. It was atrocious. So there was a reason why he would type. I can only imagine he probably did that with the letters occasionally too, where he would go back over them. But I actually was rereading them this morning and I hadn't read them in a while. And one of them was so cute because I guess he went back to proofread it. And he was saying, my God, I can't believe people pay me to write. He's like, this is very basic. So let me actually spend some time getting a little more detailed. It was very cute.
So speaking of paying to write, when we talk about your dad,
yeah.
your dad is iconic.
He would love to hear you say
that. Well, I'm going to say that. For our younger listeners who can find everything now on Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, your father's shows exist in the zeitgeist.
They do.
So tell our young listeners some of the amazing shows that your father was a part of, not just for television, but major motion pictures as well.
Yeah, mostly TV, because at the time, TV writers weren't cool enough to write movies. So his success came predominantly with a show that when I was a kid, I used to give him so much grief, and I would tell him he would try to give me notes on my own writing, and I'd tell him he was old. I just want to smack myself around for saying, because now they just did a piece in the New York Times that during COVID, one of his shows is one of the most watched shows on streaming right now. And it's a show called Columbo that he created the year before I was born. And it's still on the air. And I'm only 12. No, it's been on for a long time. And, you know, in many different languages. So Columbo, and he also created a show called Murder, She Wrote that actually continued on after he passed away. And then he did films that I know kids don't know because I have kids of my own, but he did a television film that was the first interracial couple on television called My Sweet Charlie. He did a film called That Certain Summer that was the first film about a homosexual relationship on television. So he broke a lot of ground and he really loved what he did. So it was very inspiring to sit at a dinner table with him every night. He would kvetch and whine about directors and actors and network executives. But overall, he really believed in telling stories that mattered.
I loved your mother, but you are your father's daughter. Ever since that, but you really are the embodiment of your father.
Literally. Literally. I have his build, which is frustrating when you're a teenage girl. But yes, I'm very tall.
As a young girl, did you have any idea that you would follow in his footsteps, that you too would become this prolific writer in the entertainment industry?
It's such a good question, Erin, because it's so funny. You know, I look to people who I admire to see if they knew what they wanted to do when they were young. I'm always so impressed when people are like, I was 3 years old when I knew I wanted to be a genetic, you know, physicist. It's so funny. But I say that I didn't know. And I think in part it was because I wanted to be my own person. So I think I didn't want to follow. It's like if your dad sells shoes, you don't want to sell shoes because that's what your dad does, right? And that's lame. But I always told stories and he always inspired me to do so. And it was fun, again, looking at these letters that he wrote, I was younger than 10, and I wrote my first piece called Murder Among the Rich. And he chastised me for not finishing it.
Have you finished it since?
I should go. Well, the funny thing is I'm a television writer, and I went on to write Law & Order, among other shows. And it's the same conceit. I'm like, this is hilarious that I'm like 8 or 9 years old, and I was literally writing what I would later write. And he was wonderful at inspiring me without smothering me or giving me too much guidance. He let it be my own thing. And I fought it kicking and screaming until literally in through college, I was still saying, I'm not going to do that while I was writing scripts at college. And the reason I got a job out of college writing for television is because I had a script in my trunk and I hit a producer with my car. And he asked me what I wanted to be. And I said, I'd maybe a writer because I have this script. And he happened to run a show called The X-Files. And he offered me a job after he read the script. So no nepotism. But yeah, clearly I always wanted to be a writer. I think it was just really important for me to find a way to do it on my own terms.
You know, I recently interviewed Anna Quinlan.
Oh my gosh.
And
so
I knew
incredible.
She went to your alma mater, you and Barnard, yeah. Before you transferred to Stanford.
Yeah.
And what she loved about Barnard was the environment for women, just nurturing that intellectual spirit.
Yeah.
So did you go to college thinking you were going to be a writer, or did you discover it while you were there?
It was interesting. I actually decided to take a year off before starting college. And that's where I figured, a lot out. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that, I'm burying the lead, my father passed away when I was 14, suddenly of a heart attack. And that was not the plan. And I didn't stop to feel. I was a very serious student, and I took summer courses, and I kept myself very, very busy. And then as my friends were all heading off to college, I decided to defer for a year from Barnard, and they were great about it, because I decided I was going to deal with grieving for my father, because I was very structured, and I thought that that would work out great. I would take a year.
A gap year.
Yeah.
A gap year,
gap year to grieve. Just cry, get it all out. Note to every, that doesn't work. It's a great idea. Doesn't work. But what I did during that year is I traveled with my mom, who was more fun than anyone, and I adapted a short story into a screenplay. And that was the first time I'd done it. It was an Ethan Kanan short story from a book called Emperor of the Air, which was beautiful, all about a daughter and her mother who was a klepto, which I thought was fascinating. And years later at Stanford, he came to speak at a bookstore, and I actually went to talk to him about it. And he was so sweet and clearly more interested in film than in fiction. And so he wanted to hear how I adapt. And I said, oh no, I just was making it up. I didn't know what I was doing, but it was a wonderful experience. Turns out he teaches at Iowa, which is where my then husband was studying, and I didn't know it. So it all kind of comes full circle. But that year, I felt safe enough to try. So that was when I think I really actually, all joking aside, wrote my first script, did all the formatting on my own. I had no idea what I was doing. I was hitting tab a lot for characters and for description, and figured it out, and then kept writing once I was at school. But Barnard was just a place. My dad said something very wise, which I will, if this sparks to anyone out there, he will have done his job, because it certainly impacted me. If you want to be a writer, you will write. So take the opportunity while you can to learn everything. Don't specialize too soon. Don't lock down. I was lucky enough, I got into Tisch at NYU as well, and I turned it down because I knew that I would lock into just writing for TV or just writing movies. And I was like, well, if I'm going to do that for the rest of my life, right now I want to take civil engineering, which if I can impart any wisdom on it, avoid that. That was bad. But I took some brilliant courses. I took art history at Barnard that was extraordinary. I took feminist studies that blew my mind. And I took some short story classes. So it was just being able to dip your finger in a lot of pies. And all of that has had a huge impact on my writing, because my job is to write, you know, to be a doctor, to be a lawyer, to be a widow, to be all these things. And to experience that, you have to know more than just how to write a script.
Let's go full circle.
Yes,
we,
please.
We are in your childhood home.
Yes.
I just got to go to your daughter's bedroom, who is the same age at 7 years old, when you made this proclamation to your father that you were not going to read any of these letters that you knew existed until you were really, really old at 21 years old.
It sounded so old. I mean, 21, you can do everything when you're 21, right?
So your dad would write these letters. He would seal them
yes.
every year. And you knew they existed since which age? Like, when did you?
Oh, probably birth. I mean, the man did take his writing. He was very proud. He's a proud man. So he talked about them a lot. He'd sometimes quote himself and then say, you know, I got anytime you want to read them, anytime you want to read one of these letters. And I think in part just to piss him off, but also because I knew what I was like in that moment. So I was very aware of the letter.
He called you willful.
Yes.
You were a willful child.
Can you believe? Yes, he called me a few bossy, which is an interesting and challenging word to read as a mother of a daughter now. I have two awesome kids, a 13-year-old boy and a 7-year-old girl. I think parents have gotten wise enough to stop calling their daughters bossy, because I think being bossy is a wonderful thing if done in the right spirit. But yeah, I was willful. And I think he got a huge kick out of that, although it was probably exhausting.
Your contemporary Anna Quinlan
yes.
reminded me that no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. And when I think of this story, there's tears, at least for me. Yeah. I know that you've written about this, and I know that a book eventually will manifest. So when you decided that you weren't going to read these letters until you were 21 years old, and they kept accumulating, fill the reader into what that was like as you saw this stack of beautifully written letters tied with a shoestring in a drawer, just
rainbow shoestring, which I know was my mom. That was not my dad. That was definitely my mom keeping them neat. Yeah. I, you know, I think it's absolutely something that you take for granted. You take your parents for granted. You're supposed to, because they're constant. And I think as a parent, I'm doing my job if my kids feel safe and adored and cherished and controlled to a certain extent. And it is true, as you mentioned, and I'm not going to glaze over it, I live in the house I grew up in. So first my son Leo and now my daughter Margot have my old bedroom. And I write my scripts in the same office my dad wrote the letters and his scripts. So it's, I don't think a terribly typical thing, specifically for people who live in Los Angeles. There's no history here, but I love the fact that I walk into a room and it's full of history. Some of it good, some of it bad. My father actually passed away in this house. So there's, it's loaded. So I totally took it for granted until he died.
So let's go to March of that year. And you're, as a young 14-year-old girl, the floor must have fallen out. What was that like to be 14 and you're an only child? Yeah. And to receive that news?
It's interesting because it's from a perspective of an adult, you know? And so it's so interesting to me now. As I said, my son Leo is 13. And we were driving and I randomly looked at him and said, oh my God, you're a year away from being the age I was when my dad died. And of course, God bless him, he looked at me and said, and in lighter news, because it's a little heavy, but you think you're so grown up when you're 14 and you think you know everything. And even, and in the letters, he talks about that, that I thought I was smarter than him. And he very sweetly said, someday you will be, but not yet. But yeah, you think you're so grown up and wise and experienced. You're a kid and you should be. Look, everybody has their baggage to bear. I only know mine. It's too soon to lose a parent. And I think I look back at it at so many different stages because I'm nearing the age. He was 52, which is also crazy young. And when you're 14, you think that's crazy old. And it's not. So it was also one of those things where everything was planned. You're moving forward. And because, as I said, he had a heart attack and died completely suddenly, you just wake up, you go to bed, and the world is one way. And you wake up, and I was getting ready for school. And you're going to go to school and it's a normal day and you're probably pissed because you have a quiz and you're thinking about the guy that you're kind of into and, you know, how you, what you're going to eat for lunch. And then everything has changed. But you also, I was just telling my husband Antoine this the other day, you can't fathom that. Someone can say, and they did, the most kind police officer, you know, the coroner had to come and the police, and these, there are people in your house that you don't know. And he was so kind in alleviating my mom's pain. Because he said this was massive and there was no way that he could have survived this type of a heart attack. And he also saw something on the wall and he said, I loved Columbo, which my dad would have loved. So it was one of these things where you're trying to digest and everybody around you looks really sad. So you know it's real, but it's surreal. You can't in that moment know, which is, I think, why I took that gap year, right? Because you're still trying to understand what it means to now have no dad. And you know me really well. He's such a huge part of me. He crammed a lot into 14 years. And so I'll say things or I'll catch a look of myself in a mirror or I'm so clearly his. No doubt of, I was never the kid who could do a DNA test to see if I was adopted because that was never in doubt. It's funny. I think I understand more now what it means than I could have understood. On March 12th, you know?
On March 12th, in your search for meaning to make sense of this, why didn't you open the first letter? Did you still have that, I have to wait till I'm 21 in my mind? Was it the willful Chrissy still there?
First of all, you're so overwhelmed. There were so many people in the house for like ever. A lot of people have lost parents now. And it's not easier when you lose a parent as a grown-up. I lost my mom 5 years ago. It still sucked. But when you're a kid, there's an extra thing because everybody's looking at you and they want it to be okay, but they're emotional too. And my dad was a big force, both in the television industry, but also he had a lot of friends. And my mom was a 47-year-old woman who was left alone with a kid. Like, it was a lot for people. So I didn't even think, the letters were not in my brain at that point. I think I was too busy trying to be okay for everybody, to be honest.
So how did the letters go from the house to that safe deposit box at Bank of America?
That mom again, definitely mom. My mom was very very organized. When my parents were dating, my mom was a Broadway singer. My mom came from, her dad was a coal miner. She had zero money. And she got herself to New York and ended up on Broadway. My mom had a lot of chutzpah. And my dad met her there.
And he asked her to marry him a dozen times.
Like six times. Yeah, she had no interest in getting married. Like none. And he just badgered her until she agreed, thank God. Or I would not be sitting here. But he loved that she could sing. And they went to a party. It was the 60s. And I think my dad tried getting high. My parents were very straight. So he tried smoking pot and whatever, and he took notes because he was a writer. So he wrote, nothing is happening. Absolutely nothing. I don't understand why. And then literally the pen just slides. And my mom found it and to organize it, wrote, Richard gets high and put a date on it and filed it away. So my mom was definitely responsible for putting the letters in the bank deposit box because that's my mom. God bless her. And to answer your initial question about why I didn't read the letters right away, because that's what I told my dad. So it wouldn't be
like
true.
Like to honor your oath.
Yeah. I think that's totally what it was. That it was like, well, but I promised him that, which is ridiculous because he wrote them for, but in my mind as a kid, I was like, well, that was the plan. So I was going to be true to the plan. And then also, and I've mentioned this before, that's all I had left. So it's not like they were going to continue forever. It's if I read them, then there are no more conversations and then it's done. And so you want to have this kind of precious continuing conversation.
So at 21,
yeah,
you go to the bank.
I do.
And you're ready. And I'm starting to feel emotional just imagining a 21-year-old handshaking, heart palpitating. And what do you decide to do that very first moment, to read a singular letter, to just sit in that room?
I mean, do you remember being 21?
I don't remember anything.
I know, right? I'm like, honestly, you're taking me back,
this,
right?
I know,
no,
you remember this.
I do. God, and it's so serious. And I do love following rules. My dad actually tried to break me of that habit. I took everything so seriously. Like, he made me ditch school one day, and we watched Citizen Kane. Now, it's the coolest thing. Then, I was like, Dad, it's black and white. Why are you making it? And he was like, but there are ceilings in the shot. This is incredible. And I was like, whatever. And now I look back and I'm like, I can totally see I'm going to end up doing that to my kids. But anyway, because he was right. He'd be thrilled to hear me say that too. I did. I drove to Bank of America, which is still there. I don't know what, I'll be devastated if it's still like this silly little building with very ample parking. And I went in and I don't know that I had a game plan walking in other than that I was ready to read them. I barely made it through the first letter. I hadn't heard his voice. And he's a beautiful writer. And he was talking to me. And I hadn't heard that. And so poor people in the bank, I was just, I cried a lot. And I only got through the first letter, but a couple of times, which for some reason is my touchstone. Like, I'll go back and read the first letter every once in a while. And to be clear, by the way, I haven't read all of them still.
Still.
There are sections of a couple of the, I've read the first one. I'm such a cheat. I've read the last one, but there are a couple towards the end that I haven't quite read all the way through for that exact reason, because I
don't,
like,
want it to be over.
No.
Would you read a passage from the first letter?
Oh my God, I'd love to. June 14th, as I date myself, 1972, 3 a.m. To my daughter. Today you were born. Oh, see, there I go. Today you were born. At 1:15 this morning, a man named Dr. Adler, not even our doctor, you came so quickly and so easily that our doctor arrived 10 minutes late, lifted you into the world while your mother, awake and laughing, and I, in a mask and gown, watched the very moment of your birth. And I wanted you to know how happy we were to see you and to have you. And what a lovely 9 months it was for your mother and me. We knew you'd be a girl. I don't think one of our friends predicted a boy. And there you were, with fingernails and blue eyes. And your mother wondered if your hair, which was curly just a few hours ago, would be curly always. At this time, there is a method of giving birth to children called the Lamaze method. Maybe when you're older, it will be the major way for mothers to have their children. Or maybe it will be replaced by something else. But for the first time, under this method, fathers stay with their wives through labor and go into the delivery room to see and help with the birth. I was frightened and nervous about it, but you came in such a lovely way and so quickly We arrived at the hospital at 10:45, and just a few hours later, there you were. Welcome to the world, my dear, dear daughter. At this moment in my life, I am happy. Your mother and I love each other very much. Things go well with my work. Outside, our private world is a larger world, and it is troubled. There has been a divisive war in Southeast Asia that seems endless. Certain attitudes of certainty in this country are changing, and things are in great flux. But perhaps this is true of all times, and will be true when your children are born. I just want you to know that your mother and I love you, and that you have given us great joy even before your birth. We'll try to make things happy for you here. Good night, your father. Yeah.
What I love about these letters is he's commentating on the world.
Oh.
On you and the Vietnam War, clearly.
He had opinions, yes. Yeah. It was very important to him and he even comments on this. His goal was, he said he couldn't remember being a child himself. And it was so important to him for me to be able to look back and remember what I loved to eat, who my friends were, who my enemies were, but also on a larger scale, what was going on in the world. So there are flashes of, you know, the oil crisis, you know, because you do read that now. And I think, oh my God, think of the last of all times this past year. Mm-hmm. And I'm very aware about what my kids were, the choice that you make to bring a child. I don't think my parents took that lightly. They didn't have easy childhoods, either of them. And they waited until they were their friends called them, the old childless ones. They waited to have me. So no, he was very both opinionated, but also aware.
So after you read the first letter,
yes.
Did you leave the letters in the safe deposit box?
For a couple of years. Oh, they're still there.
They're still there.
Oh, yeah. I'm reading from a mom. I believe it was my mom made photocopies. So I have a binder at home. But yeah, no, they're still there. And they're
with the shoestring?
With the same shoestring. Yeah. And by the way, next to them, I'm also jumping ahead. I write my kids' letters. And so I have letters for Leo and letters for Margot there as well that I write to them. I didn't write the night they were born because I actually gave birth and therefore was not in the mood to write letters. I was tired. But I write right around their birthdays every year and do the same thing to them. Where I'm like, they're letters. They're there. You can have them. But they're going to wait. So,
and they haven't read them yet.
Nope. And
Do you find your voice is his voice? Are there idioms and vernacular that he would have used that you kind of creep into the writing?
Do you know what's funny is I've never truly, truly ever felt any pressure to be a television writer daughter of a very successful award-winning television writer because he loved me and he would thrill at any success. If I wrote, you know, copy for a shoe store, he would have been thrilled. Never feel pressure in that. Totally feel pressure writing the letters because I'm like, there's a turn of phrase or there's an observation and I think I beat myself up where sometimes I'll write a letter and it reads too much like a list, which is why I was so tickled today when I reread one when I was like 9, where he said, I feel like I'm just writing a list. I'm like, oh, thank you. So definitely there's an inspiration there. I think as I was saying before, it's not just about who my kids are. It's about the world that they're part of. And my dad was always very much that type of thinker. So yeah, that does. I don't know if our writing styles are the same. I'd be thrilled if they were. We're both mystery writers or of a sort. And so I like to think my plotting is inspired by him. But yeah.
I loved how he would write about girly things too. Your blue eyes turning green and, you know, your friends. He was very observant about your friends.
And prophetic. I mean, I can look back with some knowledge about some of those friendships. He had such wise perceptions about, and that I beat myself up with my kids too. I'm like, what am I missing? He would pick up on things. He would talk about what concerned him. He was very worried that as a young girl, I was too aware of my looks and that I put way too much pressure on myself to look a certain way. And he said, you know, we try to inspire you to think more about your brains or to think more about being kind. And that, okay, so I read the letters before you came over this morning. I was bawling because he does. He talks about, it's very wide. This is not a therapy session, I promise, but just insecurity mixed with great confidence. And I think I'm nearing 50. And as a woman in this industry that has always been very male dominated, although it's shifting, never enough, but it is shifting. That's definitely been something that I've struggled with. And for him to be able to comment on that, then makes me look again at my daughter in a way too. I say when I grow up, I want to be her. She is just completely confident. And I'm like, when did that change? When does that get shifted? I want to say taken from girls.
But think about how such an iconic role, a female role, was created by your father. Murder, She Wrote is epic. And it's this powerful role with Angela Lansbury.
Oh,
do you think your mother and you had any inspiration in your father creating this role that had a female protagonist?
That's a lovely, I think Agatha Christie was probably his biggest influence. But my dad, if asked, he would tell you women are far superior to men. My dad loved writing women, was fascinated by them. Most of his closest friends were women.
So he was a feminist.
Oh, big time. And I mean, that's so fun. Like in this letter that he spends that much time talking about Lamaze and for like being able to be part of this experience that he fully said was, you know, the woman is going through. No, he was an avid, he wanted a daughter. Like that, he didn't mention that in the letter, but he definitely mentions it later where he really wanted a little girl. And he constantly told me not to be beaten down, not to ever question that I was just as good as the boys, not to ever doubt myself that absolutely, he was a huge supporter of that. And I love that he created, along with Angela, who breathed life into it and is one of the world's most amazing women and lovely to boot. I hadn't thought of it that way, but no, I'm sure that had very much to do with it.
What was your second letter you read?
I think I did go in order.
Did you go in order?
I did go in order.
You're very methodical. You're very methodical.
What are you saying,
Aaron? So I was curious if it was like when every year would be a new letter. What was the timeline?
It was funny. And this is weird because I didn't do it. I kind of did it. I let my emotions guide me. But it was for the first little bit, it was definitely one a year-ish. And I did the first two or three. And then I started to bounce. And then I'd take breaks because, I didn't want to run out. The one time I did sit down to read a chunk of them all at once was when I was turning 30, and in part because I was writing an article about it, and that's when I read them all in a chunk, but I always read the first one again. But yeah, I did one, two, and three were my kind of, and then I would bounce, and then I cheated and read the last one.
So when you read the last one, what did that feel like? Did you feel like you were cheating?
That was hard. The last one was hard because you do the math, you know? You're like
March and June.
Yeah. Like, you're like, how much longer did I have with him? You realize that that's the last he's going to know you. And it just, that one's very loaded. And he also ended it in a rather, I don't know, I am not a goony guru kind of person. And I don't believe in, oh, we know things or, oh, we know. But he told me things. It was very, we used to go on dates. We'd go out for dinner, we'd get dressed up, and I would get two Shirley Temples, which was like a big night out. But he would tell me things about his life and about his childhood. He lost his mom when he was 18. And I can now say that influence is how you parent. And I think he wanted to cram a lot into, I'm damn sure that had a lot to do with why he wrote these letters. It's a fear that you're not going to be around. And he would tell me things on our dates about his dating life. And I would be like, Dad, this is horrible. Tell me that I'm 9. But I'm so happy that he did because I wouldn't have known it otherwise. So yeah, he ends the last letter differently than the other ones. And it just, I found it very emotional, but also very telling. And maybe I'm reading something into it. And maybe, you know what I mean? Because it's like you suffer from too much information. Usually he would just kind of go through things and then and say wonderful stuff about how much he loved me, which was pretty great.
Do your children have any desire to sit down and read these letters?
Aaron, they're kids. They think I'm terribly boring. I'm very fond of my husband, and we just celebrated 18 years of being married, and you know him well because
I was at that wedding.
I know. But yeah, Antoine says, and it means more than anything to me, that he feels like he knew my dad, and he didn't. We have pictures of him up around the house. I talk about him all the time. And it's not morbid and it's not depressing. It's a huge part of my life. And we live in his house. So my kids hear about him all the time. And actually during COVID, one of the great joys was we watched Columbo. And there's actually an episode where my mom was an actress. She dies in it. She's murdered. So we watched the one where Grammy Rose gets beamed in the head with a rock. And it's a great one. It's called Suitable for Framing. And it's one of the best plotted Columbos there is. And my son Leo loved it. My daughter, not so much.
She's 7.
She's 7. So we watched the Murder, She Wrote pilot. She's like, this I like. So they're very opinionated. So I tell them about these letters. I this morning was just trying to tell my son about them. It's not them, so it's not terrible. I think when they get older, they'll be more interested.
Would you share a passage from one of your favorite letters?
Yeah. I'm going to randomly pick because I love them all. So this is from a combo. This is the only time that he combined a year. It was 2 and 3, but this I kind of love. He was messing around with the spelling of my name. I'm named after my mother's mother, Christine. I go by Chrissy in life and Chris in work. But he tried spelling it with an IE on this letter, which really pisses me off because I'm a Y, which he clearly adapted to after that. I'm like, Dad. Anyway, so this is age 2. What can I tell you about yourself? The conventional wisdom now is that children are formed within a few years. If so, you're lucky because you're an extremely happy little girl. You laugh, you have exuberance and zest and more energy by far than your mother and me put together. You're also trusting and open. Since you were born, I look at other children more carefully, and they're not all nice. Some are sly or cowardly or aloof, but you sail in with open arms, and I mean that literally. When you're in the park or wherever you meet new kids, you rush up and immediately try to hug them. You've knocked a few down with this rush of love, but that doesn't stop you. You've decided that your form of greeting is going to be an embrace, and by God, that's what it is. A few have run in terror, but others embrace you right back. Literally, I had a boss on a show when I was 30 years old who was I think he would openly admit now that he was a misogynistic, not a great open-minded man. And he said, "You made me a feminist and a hugger." So the thing that's amazing is you don't change. In some
but
ways.
But I think when I met you 2 decades ago, and the way he describes you then is the way I felt when I met you. And I was so, I wish people could see instead of just hear, you are exquisitely gorgeous.
Oh, geez.
And as beautiful as you are brilliant, you could probably intimidate people, but you're so full of zest, like your father said. So I just couldn't believe someone of your caliber would want to hang out with someone like me.
Oh my
God. Which is crazy.
I'm lucky to be in a room. Are you kidding me?
But that's how I felt. Like how she's talking to me. She wants to give me a hug. So I think your dad saw that beautiful part of you. And I'm glad that that part of you's never gone away. Because I think you're still like that. You still have that zest. You're still so open. You just make everybody feel like they're the only person in the room.
Well, first off, that's love. One thing I've learned with maturity is to actually hear that. So thank you. What an awesome thing to hear from someone I respect and admire so much. I'm just happy it hasn't been kicked out of me. Because it really is. I work in a business that's ridiculous. Let's be abundantly clear. And it is full of rejection and frustration. And I've been very lucky, and I want to say talented, in that I've been doing it for 26 years and I work. It's hard to peel yourself up off the floor. And in this past year with the world shut down, I was lucky enough to, I shot a pilot in New Orleans and I went and then it got passed on about 4 weeks ago. And I've just been really missing my parents because they pick you up off the floor and they tell you that you're great. You know, what a wonderful thing to have parents if you're lucky enough to have one who does that. And mine got taken from me way too soon, both of them. But what's funny is like that, so that's what I believe. But then you read this, and I'm so grateful for it because I'm like, that's how I'm built. I am resilient and I am genuinely happy because I'm a lucky creature and I get to do what I love to do. And I get to be, you know, I have a happy marriage, all these things, but it's naturally at 2 years old. That's what I do. I'm a hugger.
I love that he said some ran in fear.
Oh, and they should. My God, I'm very tall. And I did. There's actually a picture in my yearbook of me and my then best friend, and she's crying, but it looks like she's laughing, but I know she was crying. Because I did. I ran, hugged her, picked her up, and I dropped her.
Like it was like WWE.
It was bad. It was bad. She hit her head on the cubbies. It went wrong.
Well, with these letters, what were there moments where your dad picked you off the floor and you didn't even know he was picking you up off the floor? Like when you feel at your lowest, a paragraph or two in a letter can bring you up again.
Oh. The truth is every word does because he was writing them to me, to be totally honest. It doesn't have to be fancy or frilly or whatever, but it is things like, as this might sound silly, but it matters to me. And you asked that he said that I'm aware of others, which is something that that matters a lot to me. And he's like down to, I guess I gave him a lecture about killing an ant. that other people's suffering matters a lot to me. And that he knew that, and that he could see that even when I was a kid. And it's not something I broadcast, it's not something I talk about. It's just something I try to live, and I hope honestly my kids notice it, that strangers fascinate me as much as people who are very close to me, and that he noticed that makes it matter and touches me. And I think also that he commented a few times, I know my parents' marriage got better when they had me. And that matters a lot to me too, because as I said, they both came from really dysfunctional families, and my mom was not in a hurry to get married, and my dad was opinionated and used to being the prince and the kind of most important boy in the room, and he had to learn how to be kind. And my mom said that I helped teach him that, and that he every year got nicer and nicer to a point where they were so nuts for each other when he died. So it was this progression that I think that us as a family unit, and he writes about that, that gives me great joy.
With the style of writing that your father did,
yeah,
and now that you do, you know, some writers do memoirs. You very much like science fiction and mystery and the creation of characters. Do you think that comes from your father? Because he created these characters.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's funny. I'm trying to, technically, let's talk about writing. No, I lean heavily into plot. That is my comfort zone. And that is from him. It's not a typical quality in writers. I find it very frustrating when I go to the movies, the films. I almost said when I used to get to go to the movies, which I hope I get to again, because there's nothing better than a bucket of popcorn and a good movie. But specifically television shows, I'm very angry if they're plotted poorly. I'm infuriated. And it's the hardest thing to do. When they're done well, I'm amazed. I could go deeper into character. And that's something I'm still 26 years in working on. And the fact that he created characters that were so indelible and were so beloved is really inspiring. But I also, again, not treading in his footsteps, but the plot, which cracks, like he took me to see Mousetrap, Agatha Christie. It's good, guys, go read it or see it. It's dated, but it's fabulous. And it ended and he turned to me and said, where were the plot holes? And I had to, and there were some, and that was immediate, that was our language, where he would ask me questions and I would find things. And actually, oh, this has nothing to do with the letter, but I have to tell you, although I'm sure it's in here somewhere. He was working on a television film, beautiful cast. I have no idea how it got so far because they were clearly in prep. They were about to shoot it and the ending wasn't working. And we were sitting at the dining room table that's right in there. And he was so nervous about it. And my mom could tell, like, he didn't usually get tied in knots. And I said, what's going on? Because we would always talk about our days. And he said, the ending's not working. And I said, well, what is it? And he told me what the situation was. The plot was the narrator was a famous director. His girlfriend was an actress who was murdered in her apartment. They had reset her apartment up on stage in a theater. And all the suspects were there. Very Agatha Christie. And the killer was the cop who was sitting in the audience. How do you turn the table on him? And I said, well, and I'm sure it wasn't this fluid, but I like to think it was. I said, all the lights go out. And everybody's screaming, and it's crazy, and oh my God, this is scary, there's a killer in here, and this is crazy. And then a flashlight turns on, and it goes from face to face, and all of a sudden, all the characters, the suspects, are very calm. And the director says, house lights, and the lights come up, and the cop is holding the flashlight. And the director says, where'd you get the flashlight? And the cop says, well, in the craziness, I just ran up and I went through all the drawers and I found it. And he says, try all the drawers. And the cop goes to every drawer and every drawer is locked, except the drawer with the flashlight and the murder weapon, meaning the cop had been in the apartment before and yada, yada, and they arrest him. Whatever. My dad looks at me, not a word, jumps up from the table, comes running through the room we're sitting in right now, runs into his office, which is now my office, calls his writing partner, and they used it. And I got not a credit, not membership in the Writers Guild, because God forbid, I got a pasta maker and a Barbie doll. But they used it. And it was like, I'm sure that was where I got my plotting sense is so ingrained. But yeah, that was our sweet spot. That's what we did together.
Now with Columbo, he's such a curmudgeon.
Yeah.
Did your dad have any curmudgeon ways?
Oh, of course
not. Was there any projection of your...
No, of course. Well, he likes to say Columbo is loosely based on a Dostoevsky character because it sounds very highfalutin, and I'm sure there's truth to that. But no, my dad would frequently pick one side of an argument, even if he didn't agree with it, simply because he loved to debate. He got us thrown out of Thanksgiving dinner one night because he actually took the side of an anti-feminist and pissed off the host so much she booted us. And I was like, can we please eat before we go?
Goodbye,
and the answer was no. No, we could not. So my dad, definitely that. And the raincoat, he had a bathrobe that had a similar trajectory. It was very old. But yeah, no, there was definitely qualities. My sweet dad, he didn't like anything itchy. He didn't like any, no, but he was a specific man who liked things. But he was also like wicked funny. And yeah. And awesome.
Did he write about those characters in his letters to you?
You know what? He, bless his heart, for a writer who was very lauded and very celebrated, he would just say, my work goes well. Or he would talk about me coming to visit. I did notice he glossed over. His dream was to do a Broadway musical because he was a Philly boy. And that to him was better than any TV show. And he did get to do a musical with a lot of people who folks listening to this won't know, but it was Nathan Lane and Cheetah Rivera and Doug Henning, who was the world's most famous living magician. And my dad was a magician.
Did your mom get to be a part of this Broadway?
No, my mom got to stay home in LA and raise me. So she was not, he was gone for a year.
Wow.
And you look back on that and that sucks. Like it was 9 months, but it felt like a year because the director decided to get divorced and quit. So my dad had to stay in New York and do a lot of the work on his own. But we would go, oh my God, Aaron, it was so cool. We would go because there were magic tricks where like a woman would turn into a leopard or a horse would be raised. It was Merlin. It was the magical musical. So it was all Merlin times. A horse would be raised into the air above the audience and the cage would drop and it was gone. And I got to go backstage and I was 9 and it was like the coolest thing. He brought me out on stage. I was the narrator in my school play that year. And it was the Mark Hellinger Theater on Broadway. And during rehearsal, he brought me out on stage to an empty audience and I got to practice my lines. I know this because now I'm in his shoes. Because he was missing it. And so it was him getting to have the experience of hearing me do my lines because he had to work. And now flip to this past January, I was in New Orleans shooting a pilot and my daughter was doing a piano recital home in LA. God bless Zoom. So I had Zoom on my phone on my director's chair and my headphones on watching a scene being shot of my pilot. And I would turn back and forth between the video village watching the scene and my daughter on Zoom. And I go back and forth and I realized afterwards and I clapped. And afterwards there were 6 crew members watching me. And they were like, that's what it looks like when a mom works. And I was like, thank you. So my dad taught me that, which is pretty cool. Yeah.
I want another letter.
Okay. So I want to share with you, oh, there's so much. So I met me being a picky eater and how much he loved when I would dance. It's these things. It's just lovely. So 1975. Ah, crazy. This was a week before Father's Day and my birthday. And he closed the letter. And this is just something, so many details. And I'm so unable to capture your essence. And why should I? It's a free thing beyond analysis. Someday when you're grown, you may read these letters to see if you can find in them some hint of what you were as a child. I'm almost 41, and the little boy I was is almost lost to me. He exists at great distance in photographs and half memories. It may be the same with you, or possibly reading these, you may catch a glimpse of something buried very deep. I do know that I never thought of myself as a father to be, but now that I am one, I can't possibly explain to you the joy that it's been. You've given us so much, you little bundle. Hopefully we've given you some of that joy back. Happy birthday, my dear little girl. I love you.
Mm.
Yeah. Notice I'm reading from the early years and I'm not going to the teen years where he's like, and you push me and you challenge me and it's great.
The age you are now, find a letter that would represent your father at your age now.
That would be, okay. It begins, boy, oh boy. This is very sweet because he says, here I am ready to write to you about you on the verge of your 12th year and I'm hopelessly intimidated.
That's a great line.
Right? I'm so happy he heard that. Okay, so sorry, this is 1984. Each year I feel that you're coming into your own, but this year there's no question that you have, in the span of 12 months, you've gone from a child to a young woman. In some ways, you're as mature as the teenagers of my day, but thank God there's still the glimmer of the child in you. See, this I love because he just nails me. And I'm like, how does he know this? Because we're all still kids, which is the secret to adults, guys, is we're just wrinklier kids. Here's the other thing that I love. Oh, look at this. Oh, Aaron, Look at this. I'm sorry. This fascinates me. So basically, I was a picky eater, but this is interesting. So when I'm 12, I did know I wanted to be a writer. And I referenced this to you, but it's funny because he says, you still say that you want to be a writer. And it's funny, as an adult, I erase that, which is fascinating. See, these are good. You started writing a script some months ago called Murder Among the Rich, but you never finished it. At times, you do seem to have a problem following through and completing things. I got better. You have excellent ideas. You throw them off like sparks, but sometimes you then proceed to forget about them as if just having the idea is enough. Not true as a grown-up. So I find interesting, is I started to push him away, which is our job, right? You hit teenage years and you're supposed, but I didn't think I was losing him. But he does talk about me turning into a teenager and that it's this pull and push of wanting to be close to him and telling him that he doesn't get it. I guess that was my favorite phrase, which I'm waiting for my son to start saying. You've decided that I don't understand what's going on. It's much too complicated in your view for me to follow. And you'll all but pat me on the head sympathetically because I'm just not with it. Well, my little sweetheart, I'll try to keep up as best I can.
Wow.
So, yeah. He talks about my mom's brother died the year before my dad did, unfortunately. And he talks about loss in his last letter to me. And this is fascinating. So in his last letter to me from 1986, he gets the spelling of my name very right. Oh, wow. I'm sorry, this is sweet. I hadn't read this before. So this resonates. Can I read this a little bit?
Oh, I'd be honored.
Dearest Chrissy, I'm starting this today because it will be a long one. And it's his last one. And I'll keep adding right up to your birthday. Oddly enough, 34 years ago tonight, a musical I did in my senior year of high school opened. It was one of the happiest times of my life. So May 2nd has always stuck with me all these years, all of which isn't particularly relevant to your life these past 12 months, but what the hell? And to me,
that's him.
That's so him. And it's also being a parent, which I didn't know when I was reading these, because you're always trying to figure out how your kids are fitting into the world, which brings up so many memories about who you were. You know, I selfishly write letters to my kids because it reminds me of how happy I was when I was a kid and that I did. I used my favorite thing. I was just telling my son that one of my favorite things in the world was this restaurant called Trader Vic's that they bulldozed and doesn't exist anymore. It was a Polynesian tiki lounge. And I'd go with my mom and my dad, and there was this hallway that connected it to a hotel. And every night after dinner, date nights, my dad would stand in one place and he'd say, okay. And I'd run to the other end of the hallway and I'd turn around and he'd say, go. And I would just run and he'd catch me. And it was like the greatest feeling in the world because you're safe and you're loved. And I think about that all the time as a grown up because it's like, there's nothing better than that. And that's what these letters give me, is like that hug and that twirl, and you know he's not gonna drop you, you know? But then he kind of did, because he went and died. Perfect thing. Don't smoke. That's my advice. 2 packs a day, which I will share this then, because I'm not a crier and you got me. In this last letter that my dad wrote, I graduated from eighth grade. And he's talking about all the parties that I'm going to. And he ends it by saying, you're tougher lately and you contradict me more. You test your young mental muscles. And once in a while, if we fight, you grin and say, I gave you a pretty good argument. It's the truth, you do. You also think you're smarter than I am. I tell you, you're not there yet, but you will be, and I'll be very happy about it, which I just said to my son last night. You are, as always, the joy of my life. And though you're on the verge of young womanhood and beginning now to disengage ever so slightly, one of my greatest pleasures is kissing you before you go to bed, when you're sleepy and momentarily a child again. And you say, night, Daddy, love you. I love you too. And then you say, see you tomorrow. And I say that you will. I hope there are many tomorrows. If not, there have been many, many wonderful yesterdays. Happy birthday. And that was his last letter. So there. So either very wise or just how he chose to end that. But yeah.
So I would say in conclusion,
yes,
for all of those listening who have parents living or not,
yeah,
or are parents who can write to their children, what would you recommend on this Father's Day? You know, it's always around your birthday, so it's very bittersweet.
Yeah.
What could be a takeaway for our listeners who are as moved as I am? And for those of us that don't have fathers, missing our loved ones as well. I love, for a lot of the time when you speak about your dad, it's in terms of an is, not a was.
Thank you for noticing that.
So he's very present still. Yeah. So for those of us that need the is and not the was, what is your recommendation?
Let me start by saying you don't have to be a writer to do it. That's the one thing, is I have friends who are like, oh, but I can't. And I anything is precious. It can be a post-it. It can be a scribbled thought. It can be something that I love that my dad did too, which was really cool, is he just would write down quotes that I would say growing up, which are hilarious and ridiculous and telling and distinctive. It is, I don't look at death as being a morbid thing. It's like, it's part of the process. You're born and you die and you don't get to choose how long you're here. But what a remarkable thing for a child, for someone you care about, for a spouse, for anyone. But one thing I want to say is please don't be intimidated and just dive in and start small. And I find it really helpful to pick a specific time. It's why I do it on birthdays. I'm sure it's why my dad did too, is it's just a time to stop for a second. And if I've learned anything this past COVID year, it is that one, time is expansive. You do have time to do things that matter. And two, it's about people. It's not about things. If my house were burning down, I would grab my kids' letters, which are here, actually, a couple of them that I haven't put in. Like, that matters to me more than any object that I could own. So I would just say, seriously, like, jot it down, write it on your computer, put it in a file. Like I said, put it in a post-it, just anything, because it's like, go again. You don't know how long you get. And to have a memory of my dad, he's still talking to me. We're still having a conversation. And how lucky is that?
I'm so grateful for our guest, Chrissy Levinson, for sharing with us her ongoing conversation with her father. My dear listeners, may each of us cherish every moment we have with our loved ones. May we find ways to share the precious memories of our lives. And may we all create a lasting legacy with our words. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be.